Well, this is probably not a news flash, but there are lots of beneficial bugs in our gardens, and they can play a range of different roles. So on Garden Talk today, we're going to take a look at few of those and how they work for you. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad you could join us today. PJ Leash is with us. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the University of Wisconsin. Do you have questions about insects in your garden? Maybe how to attract all those beneficial ones? Well, give us a call. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Thanks so much for being with us today, PJ.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jill.
And usually you're here Wednesday, but once in a while we get you to come over on a Friday because, you know, our garden folk probably appreciate bugs a little bit more than the people on Wednesday do. But, you know, bugs get a bad rap.
They do. I mean, in my mind, it's really the situation of that proverbial squeaky wheel getting the attention.
True.
It's the ones that are nibbling on our plants or being a nuisance around our house. Those are ones that I get a lot of my questions about. But numerically speaking, the vast majority of insect species around the globe are beneficial in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of damage does it do when we're trying to get rid of those ones that do get the squeaky wheel? And, you know, because then we're getting rid of so many of the good ones.
Yeah, I mean, that is something that I really have to be cognizant of. And when folks contact me at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, maybe to identify an insect pest and discuss what to do about it, part of my job is to really lay out kind of the buffet of management options and talk about the pros and cons, the strengths and weaknesses. You know, sometimes folks can spray a insecticide to manage a pest, but if it's a broad spectrum product, that could have potential harm on all sorts of things. Maybe there are some kind of lower impact treatments that won't harm as many things, or they're only active for a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. That can be an improvement. Sometimes we have some very specific types of treatments. And over time, you know, compared to 50, 100 years ago, there were some bad pesticides. I mean, DDT, but even before that, there were various salts of lead and arsenic and things we just generally know of are not going to be good to be out there for insects and humans and other animals too. And sometimes we have these very specific products. Maybe they only work against one specific group of insects, like caterpillars, and that's going to be an improvement over something that could harm bees and beetles and all these other things. And in general, with pest management, not so much for home gardens, but we're starting to see some specific treatments that involve what we call RNAi. These are kind of molecular type treatments that are specific basically to one insect.
Wow.
And so that is really exciting in my mind that you could disrupt physiological processes within one insect species. And so over time, we're getting more and more selective. Rather than a sledgehammer, it's kind of a fine scalpel. So hopefully that trend will certainly continue. And then there's also in that kind of buffet of options, and it varies from insect to insect, but also person to person. I'm often asking questions like, how much free time do you have? Do you work from home, or are you maybe retired? That's very different than someone who works at 9 to 5, or maybe you got young kids and you're tired. and it's hard to go out there and handpick Japanese beetles for an hour or something like that. But there are plenty of non-chemical approaches. These could be kind of physical, mechanical. Sometimes we're using barriers of one kind or another to physically block access to the plants. Mm-hmm. This could be mesh netting or row covers and things like that. If the pests can't get to the plants, they can't damage them. Sometimes we can make decisions prior to planting, like choosing specific varieties or cultivars or types of plants that are maybe less prone to having issues with insects or diseases for that matter. So there's, again, this whole buffet of options. I found over time some folks want that quick solution, one and done, you spray once, it corrects the issue for the entire summer. And those kind of things, usually they're not present. And if they are, they tend to have more side effects on beneficials.
Sure. Do we tend to overreact sometimes? We see two bugs and all of a sudden our, you know, our crop is going to be gone or what have you.
I do certainly see that happen. Now, intuitively, I feel we all have this kind of general understanding that there's going to be kind of a critical number or threshold. And what I'm getting at is if you're a farmer and you see one grasshopper in your field, you're going to shrug your shoulders and you've got lots of other stuff to work on. If you went out into your farm field and you saw a billion grasshoppers, that's very different.
Right.
And so there's this idea from agricultural crops, the idea of thresholds. And folks do a lot of research to figure out, like, what's the population of these insects that actually makes a difference? When should you intervene as a farmer or grower so that you don't have economic losses? And if they're under that, it's really not going to be worth your time, effort, or money to necessarily do anything. Mm-hmm. For home gardens, it's a little bit different because each person, we have different preferences. And some folks are just going to tolerate little to no damage. And other folks will say, I've got plenty. The bugs can have some.
Right.
And I still have plenty of cabbage and tomatoes and things like that.
Some gardeners will plant specifically, okay, here's the stuff for the bugs, and this is the stuff for me. So,
yeah, and I mean, sometimes you can use that to your advantage. There are certain types of crops that insects maybe have a strong preference for. Mm-hmm. And when I've taught on campus, one example I've used along these lines is if you put out a bunch of different types of pizzas, you got pepperoni and supreme and, you know, Hawaiian pizza, people are going to pick and choose what they want. And same kind of things can happen with insects. And if you know specifically they like a certain type of squash, like Hubbard squash, for example, can be very attractive to certain insects. And if you plant that and it helps kind of draw the pests over there, and you can kind of have those sacrificial, if you will,
sure,
then that can help kind of protect the rest of your plants in the garden, a different variety.
For sure. Well, we've got a couple of callers, so let's go to Gary in Milwaukee first. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, hello. I have grapevines in my yard, and every year these vines develop galls on the leaves. And I have read that these galls are caused by aphids, and it sounds like they work their way up from the roots through the plant, and they should be able to be killed by a systemic. But the only systemic I can find that'll do the job are neonicotinoids. I don't want to use neonics. And I'm just wondering if PJ has any other, maybe a mechanical barrier. He just mentioned a mesh netting. But again, I thought these things worked their way up from the bottom of the plant. I'm not sure if that would work. But I'm wondering if PJ has any idea beyond neonics to kill these aphids.
Yeah. And Gary, in this case, are you still getting plenty of grapes on the plants?
The vines are only 3 years old. I was surprised I got enough last year to make some enough jelly to, you know, give my family. And I expect to get more this year. But I'm still getting, I'm getting grapes. And the grapes are nice.
Okay. I mean, one thought in a case like this, because the bumps, those little galls, funny looking bumps on the leaves, they are indeed caused by an aphid-like insect we call a phylloxerin. They're teeny tiny little things. So using a physical barrier, I have not personally heard of any great success with that. They are challenging because depending on the life stage of the insect, they're either associated with the leaves, and those are noticeable, or the roots. There's actually differences in terms of the types of grapes that are planted. Some just are much more prone to injury from those. I will say, though, in many cases, the insects, those galls, may be very noticeable, but the actual impacts for you might be minimal. And that's why I asked about, are you still getting grapes and are they good? If you're still getting grapes, you might not necessarily need to do anything about this. It may be more of a cosmetic thing. And with galls in general, there's galls on all sorts of types of plants out there. In a lot of cases, it leans more on the cosmetic or aesthetic side of things than a threat to plant health.
Okay. Good luck with the rest of those, with the grapes, Gary. I mean, I have grapevines growing up near my cabin in the UP. I don't do anything with them. You can barely find them because they're in the weeds. And I get tons of grapes every year. It's amazing what neglect will do.
Yeah. And actually, along those lines, there's a really interesting story with those insects. They had, at one point in history, made it over to Europe and France. The French grapevines that were there at the time were getting decimated by them. And they had to figure out a solution. It was an American entomologist here who figured out the rootstock on American grapes was much more resistant to these. And
makes
so
sense.
They actually took those and started grafting the French grapes onto American rootstock, and it basically saved the French wine industry. So there was an American entomologist who got a big French award by figuring this out.
Mm-hmm. I like it. I like it. Vivian had called, and unfortunately she had she dropped off, but she was wondering if birds eat monarchs.
They do a little bit. Of course, monarchs, as larvae, they feed on milkweeds, mm-hmm. and they can incorporate some of those milkweed toxins into their body. So not a whole lot of things eat monarchs. There are specific insects that will attack them. There are certain types of birds, but it's not a broad kind of across the board that all birds will eat them. There's a couple specific types that I have heard of. I have seen pictures from places like down in Mexico, for example. So my answer to that is for birds, it's going to be pretty minimal, but in a few cases, there's some. Other birds, if they were to try and eat a monarch, I suspect they will probably end up basically puking because of it, because of those chemical defenses.
And they've learned over the years.
Yeah, birds are smart. They learn very, very quickly that mm-hmm. this black and orange thing, you eat it, you don't feel well. And they're going to learn to avoid that.
Right. And isn't there another butterfly that copies a monarch because of that? Right?
Yeah, so there's another butterfly we have in the state called the viceroy, which also has a somewhat similar black and orange coloration. Mm-hmm. If you've never seen them before, you might mistake them for one another. And one thought behind it is it could potentially be a form of mimicry. Mm-hmm. And by virtue of that other species being black and orange, things might not eat it.
Yeah, interesting. Gotta love nature. Lori in River Falls emailed us to ask, what is the best way to control cutworms in the garden? They're targeting her peppers and radishes, and she's worried about the green bead seedlings that will be coming up soon.
Okay. Yeah, so cutworms, there's actually an entire family of cutworms, the family Noctuidae, and this group includes cutworms and armyworms. It's a very, very big family of insects. And we have a lot of species in this group. Some of them are migratory, meaning they don't overwinter here. The adults fly up, and some of these are agriculturally important for field crops, black cutworm and things like that. We also have some kind of local or resident species that can overwinter here in our climates. For those migratory species, their numbers can vary from year to year. I tell folks it's kind of a roll of the dice. If you saw them last year, doesn't necessarily mean you'll get clobbered by them again this year, because if the wind is blowing more to the east or we don't get those jet streams bringing them up here, each year can be a little bit different. For some of those local ones, you know, if you do have a local population, a couple things come to mind. In a lot of cases with cutworms, the way I think of it is if you have a big, hungry cutworm caterpillar and you have a small plant, that's a bad combination, because they tend to just cut it down at the base of the stem, and then you go out and you see it lying there on the ground, which, of course, is frustrating. That actually happened in our own backyard garden just this week. So, but for these cutworms, they have a lifespan as larvae that usually lasts about a couple of weeks. And so one thing you could do is keep an eye on things, and if you happen to see them and catch them in the act, and you say, okay, we've got big cutworm caterpillars, they're an inch and a half. I would suspect if you waited another week and a half, those would have pupated.
Oh.
They're not feeding as pupae.
Sure.
They're going to transfer them to the adult stage. They won't be feeding on plants mm-hmm. then or, you know, causing damage. And so you might be able to time it and avoid some of that damage. I always recommend to folks going out and doing some scouting. And a lot of times cutworms like to be active after dark. And so if you're not seeing them during the day, head out after dark. And it makes sense. If you're a big, juicy caterpillar and you're out at high noon, a bird's probably going to eat you and get a good meal out of it. But if you go out after dark with a flashlight, you might see them in the act. Now, if you have a small garden, you could consider hand-picking, squishing them, whatnot. Another trick you could try, because those and many other insects will like to hide during the daytime, if you have an old shingle or a board you could put on the ground, that can give them a hiding spot. And so for small gardens, if you can go out there once a day, flip over that board or shingle and, you know, squish those or pick them up and collect them, that could be a consideration. For a larger garden, that might not be as feasible, or if you're working long hours every day, that might not be as feasible. If they seem to be causing problems, you know, cutting those stems, one consideration might be to do a little bit of spraying, but you don't necessarily have to spray the whole plant. You could treat just the base of the stems where they like to chew. That's going to reduce your overall amount of spraying. Mm-hmm. And also, if you're spraying just a little bit at the base of the stem, the chances for drift, the droplets moving, mm-hmm. and risk to beneficial insects in the area is going to be greatly reduced.
Sure, more control. That makes a lot of sense.
And one other thing about that, if you go to the garden center, you can often buy products that contain the ingredient Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT. That is a specific type of bacterium with insecticidal properties. And there's the Kurstaki strain, and that's important to get that. It works against caterpillars and only caterpillars, and that could be an option. You have to keep in mind with products like that and others, it works best against small caterpillars. And if they're big, they're much, much harder to control.
Okay, you caught me during a cough. When you see that, PJ, you're supposed to continue to cough, to talk.
Noted.
Anyway, so I want to talk a little bit about, you know, like pollinators, because it's, of course, a hot topic for everybody and obviously for you. What are some of the ones that we really want to attract? I mean, we all know bees, but we don't know what kind of bees, because there's not just one kind of bee, obviously. So tell us a little bit about some of the things that we should try to be bringing into our gardens.
Yeah. From the standpoint of pollination, it's somewhere between about 85 to 90-ish% of angiosperms, those are flowering plants around the world, mm-hmm. have some sort of animal pollinator, and most animals, numerically speaking, are insects. So insects play a crucial role, and I've seen estimates, it's roughly one out of every three bites of food is due to insect pollination.
That's amazing. So,
yeah, the produce section at the grocery store would be very different if we didn't have insects. Mm-hmm. So insect pollinators, crucially important. Obviously, as you mentioned, bees, but in Wisconsin, we have between 400 and 500 species of bees. So pretty much everyone is aware of honeybee, bumblebees. We actually have close to two dozen different species that have been documented here.
No way, I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's variation in size and color patterns. And then pretty much the rest of all our other bees are these solitary creatures. They live alone. And in many cases, a given species might be active for a brief window of time, 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
In spring or the period of the year when they're active, and then they're gone and done until next year. And so you almost blink and you can miss them. So there's all these different bee species out there. Some of them can be very specialized in terms of what they do. And for gardens, a great example of that would be something we call the squash bee. These specialize on pumpkins and squash and cucurbits. They'll actually nest in the ground, maybe a foot or so in the soil near those plants. And so if you're growing those year after year, you'll probably have a population of these. This is something that in my own yard and garden, I like to show my kids, because the male squash bees, when they're done doing their business, they'll often just go into the squash flowers and nap in there. And so I've gone with my kids and opened up flowers and say, look, you can see the little bee taking a nap in there. So there are bees that are pollinators. Most folks don't realize it, but a lot of flies can be excellent pollinators. Beetles are the most abundant, most diverse group of animals on the planet. Numerically speaking, I suspect we probably have more species of beetle pollinators in the state than bees, because there's going to be thousands of beetle species in the state. There are other things that can be pollinators too. Wasps often get a bad rap, but most of our wasps are going to be beneficial predators or parasites. And so one suggestion I often have for folks, if you, in the simplest terms, want to attract more of these to your yard and garden, diversify the plants that you have and increase the number and type of flowering plants. Because a lot of these insects that might be beneficial predators or parasites, they need fuel, carbohydrates, Gatorade, if you will, so they can go about their business, and they'll come to flowers, do a little bit of pollination too. Mm-hmm. So you're getting a lot of benefits from some of those insects.
So we also, besides the variety, we want them to be blooming at different times of the year too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We have some insects, certain bees, that are basically done for the year already. They were out in April for a couple weeks. We won't see them till next April. but there is this pattern of emergence throughout the growing season. Some are early, some are mid, some are late. I tell folks, if you have, you know, 20 different plants that all bloom in your yard in July, that's awesome for the insects that are there in July. What about the ones in March, April? What about the ones in September, even October? So to have that temporal blooming pattern, that's important to think about too.
That's wonderful to know, because most of us don't realize that those little insects are only there for a little while. So has that been affected? I know that our seasons have changed because of climate change. Are the insects adapting to that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, from a certain point of view, yes. When you think about it, I mean, we obviously have climate change going on and a lot of variation from year to year. Some years, in layman's term, we have kind of an early spring. Other years, it's a late spring and so on. The insects don't have a calendar like we do. They go more by heat. And so one thing entomologists and scientists can use is something called growing degree days, which is basically a more mathematical way to look at the accumulation of heat rather than going by calendar.
Sure.
And so if things warm up early, we intuitively know this, but insects will pop out earlier. If we have snow flying until May 15th, it's just going to slow down the emergence of insects. So in that regard, you know, insects are adapting to a certain extent with their behavior and emergence patterns.
Okay. Let's see. One more thing that we've got about a minute left. So what a good question for you. What are decomposers?
Decomposers. So technically, if you're talking to an ecologist, you might refer to those as detritivores. But think of them as basically recyclers.
Okay.
These could be things like you could think of dung beetles as decomposers. They're breaking down dung specifically. But there are all sorts of detritivores or decomposers that are breaking down animal remains. You know, if there's roadkill deer, something like that, flies show up often the first thing. But there's a huge, long list of insects and related arthropods. These are things like springtails and millipedes, roly-polies and stuff like that, that are feeding on plant matter that's fallen on the ground, is decomposing. So they are helping break this down, return those nutrients to the soil and the ecosystem around them. And that's really critical in terms of what we call an ecosystem service or benefit that insects provide to the ecosystem.
And sign of a healthy soil.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay,
yes.
Great. All right. Again, beneficial insects. PJ, thanks so much for coming over. It's a short time, but we really appreciate it. PJ Leash is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. If you have a question, you can always contact him by
email, or what I'd suggest, just do a Google search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and you'll find my website.
Absolutely. Pops up right away. So thanks again, PJ. We'll really appreciate it. Stay with us, because we're going to be talking about some of those hazards that you may have for your pet in your garden.